Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Monday, December 1st, 2008 study session of Mesa City Council. Apologize for the late start.
We got it.
What do you do when the president calls, though? I didn't say he did. I just asked what you do. Take it? Okay. Item number one on the agenda, review items for the agenda for tonight's city council meeting. Page two. Councilmember Richens.
I just had a quick question on item 4A. Are we locked into that state contract for purchasing that vehicle? Or given the state of the economy, might we be able to find a better deal on an SUV from a local vendor?
What happens is that by statute, we have to go through certain bidding processes. When the state has already gone through a process and these items are available, we can order them directly off of that procurement service. So it is to our advantage. I mean, this is what's available, and it's the way it's stated, Ed, is what's the word? It's the most competitive?
It's most favored nation.
Most favored customer, most favored nation. Meaning we get the best deal that would be available throughout the state for this particular vehicle.
I think the thing that bothered me in particular is we advertise and plead with our residents to shop Mesa, and then we buy from Midway Chevrolet. And if, I don't begrudge Scott Summer's salary in Phoenix anything, but $2,500 to the city of Phoenix for sales tax revenue, might it be worth exploring keep the
Mayor
money at home?
Richens, we have had this conversation on a variety of different levels on vehicles with our local car dealerships, fleet providers, but unless they bid for these projects, we can't award the projects to them. And for some of them, this is not necessarily the particular types of their fleet or their inventory that they're trying to be most competitive with. And so it is unfortunate because we end up paying sales tax to other communities. But until such time that our local dealers participate in these bids, we won't be able
they
to
They don't
that.
Participate in the state contract?
Right.
Or we're
the most competitive. I don't know if I can't say that they actually competed.
Correct.
If we took this out to bid straight for a Tahoe, every Chevy dealer carries a Tahoe. It's not that complicated a vehicle. I mean, is there?
Ed, will you answer that question? I'm not sure.
Generally, what we would lose is the volume discounting that goes along with the state contract. State contract volumes are extremely large, and therefore General Motors, through the dealers, offers extremely good pricing. If we go out for a bid on one vehicle, we're just getting the volume of one vehicle.
Where's Bill Jibjiniak? See here. Will you get with our local car dealers and get them signed up then, if that's the case?
One thing that we could do is I was at an event at lunch, and the I think procurement and the Mesa Chamber of Commerce are actually offering a seminar, but a meeting or something with Mesa Business on how to do business with the city of Mesa.
That's correct.
And one of the things they're going to discuss is that what was handed out?
You go, Mayor.
Oh, there we go. One of the things.
It has the date on there, Mayor.
There we go. On
December
9th, there's going to be a seminar put on to educate Mesa businesses as to how they can get city business the city of Mesa. One of the things is, how do you either participate in the city and the state procurement procedures, which we all follow state law with our procurement procedures, and it's not as simple as picking up the phone and calling down to the local Chevy dealer and saying, hey, listen, we need to buy a car. Could you give us a price on it? You have to follow those steps. Generally, we assume that there are certain dealers in the state that want this business, and therefore they price it such that it's very difficult for a local dealer to beat unless they also want to play that game.
Correct.
And it's not as simple as we can pick and choose, or we can take somebody's bid and go shop it. You can't do that and still comply with state procurement. So we need our Mesa businesses to also get in the game. We'd love to give them business.
Well, when we look at the prices, do we factor in that $2,500 comes back home? It's like a rebate. What are these? $2,500 off. Buy a car here, you know.
We agree.
I mean, I'm almost inclined to bid it separately just to test the market in this economy.
We could certainly ask for those bids, but I think the mayor's really, that's where we want to get, because we'd like to get some of those sales tax dollars.
Absolutely.
So we will specifically, Mayor, reach out to all of the local car dealerships, fleets. We've had this conversation several times with
them.
We keep trying to encourage them to do that. So,
thanks.
Councilmember Summers.
In my own defense, Dave, I bought my own personal vehicle in Mesa this past year. But since you brought it up, Debbie, being employed in Phoenix, and even though this issue could have been a Tempe auto dealer or a Mesa auto dealer, hopefully will be a Mesa auto dealer next time, is there a conflict of interest at all?
There is not a conflict of interest. This would be considered at most a remote interest.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for bringing that up. Okay, page 3, Councilmember Higgins.
Mayor, 4E and 4F regarding the bid for
asphalt crack sealant.
Asphalt crack sealant. I just wondered if there was a reason to go ahead like at this time with this quote, or can we delay this project till next year when hopefully the bitum miss index goes down?
Oh, bituminous.
Thank you. That word.
Well, Mayor, Councilmember Higgins said we stay on top of this asphalt prices all the time. In fact, I sit in summits with vendors and manufacturers of this and try to figure out solutions to the increasing price. Obviously, you see the gas prices on the local pumps go down, but that's not a direct correlation to asphalt content. Asphalt oils are a heavy oil, which is typically the discharge, and those prices have been for many years extremely low. Well, when prices went up in gas, it was easier to convert that into gas and diesel. The profit margin was greater. That material is no longer easily available. What has happened throughout this contract is we still continue to do our work. We put our budget together January to do this. Our index gone up. The asphalt price has jumped almost, 87%. The base price of the crude oil itself or the heavy oils. And that ADOT index tracks that, so that we couldn't get vendors to even bid these contracts because they didn't have any escalators. They wouldn't even look at these supplies. So we still continue to do our work, but we needed this extra dollars to cover the difference. The oil prices have stayed, the asphalt prices have stayed consistent, but our ADOT escalator is coming down. We saw a little bit of decrease in the increase of the prices, but the actual base price of the asphalt stayed consistent. Anything else?
So the reason, we don't anticipate this going down in the next quarter?
Well, we can watch it. During the next quarter, if we see a substantial decrease, we can take a serious look at it, either through the ADOT escalator or also.
Those prices will continue to go down. Costs that the vendor is charging us will continue to go down. There is we're tied, we're capped at the ADOT index. The index for the asphalt products contract, if we started at the start of the contract, prices would be about 87% higher. We're actually at only 33%, and prices have started to go down. The last month we've seen decreases from 2 out of the 3 vendors, and we anticipate that will continue.
So as this comes down, you're not fixed at this higher rate?
No, we are not.
Okay.
That's correct.
The ADOT escalator will take into account the market fluctuation.
Okay.
Vice Mayor Rich, and one of these companies is a Mesa company.
I buy all my asphalt.
Very good.
I believe you just clarified that this doesn't mean we're going to spend all this. This gives you a dollar limit so that as we need it, we can procure it. But as the prices go down, we will pay less. So we're not necessarily going to spend all of
that. That is correct. It gives us a plateau, not to exceed amount. When the prices fluctuate as much, it's hard for me to guess what that number is going to be.
Right.
Let me ask you just because I'm trying to understand. We approved originally a dollar amount. We're coming back now to ask for an increase in that dollar amount because of increase in asphalt prices.
Mayor, that's correct. What happened was we got into this bind because we had to buy asphalt and petroleum-based products when prices were at their highest.
Okay.
And we ran out of buying power.
Okay.
So now that prices are falling somewhat, we still need some material. This gives us authority to buy the material to finish our program for this
okay,
year.
Okay, so if we don't approve this, then you're basically shut down because you have no material.
That's correct. Okay. We run out of asphalt.
So you run out of asphalt. What does that mean?
Well, that would shut down.
I mean, I know what it means to run out of asphalt.
Yeah.
I don't know what it means. I'm trying to figure out, we're talking about $500,000 here. So what I'm trying to weigh is, okay, I can either pay $500,000, which I understand through the cost run-up, but the costs are coming down, and it looks like you can go from $150 a barrel to $50 a barrel. Somewhere those prices are going to, that price grid is going to, or is slope is going to change.
A little bit.
So the question is does the cost of buying it now and spending an extra potentially $500,000 outweigh the cost of deferring projects and having people sit around or whatever? I mean, is that what we're faced with?
Good question, Mayor.
Thank you.
What that does slow down, what that would severely affect, if you notice on the asphalt side of it, it's not just field operations, it's not the street guys also, it's also utilities. That's used to fill in the asphalt repairs that they do for water main breaks. That means you could expect roads that would have barricades around, and that's not just the asphalt for other things, it's all the other activities we do. So we still got to continue to feed repairs on utility repairs. If we defer our seal coat program, there you get the bigger, you know, the cracks that have developed. We miss this opportunity to hit it during our time in which we do our work.
So is what I'm hearing, because I want to make sure that there's an actual cost. If it's simply a matter of, gee, we have this schedule of work and we need to get it done, then I got a problem with that. If it's what you said, which is, you know, we have ongoing needs, which we have to fill no matter what. We've spent our budget because we paid more for the asphalt than we anticipated in the original budget amount, is what I'm hearing. Then that's a different story. If it's seal coat, then, okay, so I defer a seal coat, what, 6 months, a year? Is there going to be $500,000, or maybe it's not that much? Maybe that's only a part of it. What I'm hearing from you is that there are projects we cannot defer, such as utility patches, those kind of things.
Right. And the other thing,
there are other projects we would prefer not to defer, but adding up, in your opinion, not in your opinion, but in your judgment, you're saying that we believe that the cost for delaying or deferring these projects would be greater than what we're going to spend right. with this $500,000.
That's correct, Mayor.
That's correct. And if you look at, there's two. There's a one for asphalt, concrete. We got to continue to do that. The other one is for quality emulsions, I believe it is, for our, which is our seal coat material. That is getting us prepared for May. So we're going to be looking at May. If the prices do change, we'll be coming back and looking at a different price.
Okay.
This is not the work. We don't do our too much of our seal coat stuff during the winter months other than crack seal material.
Right.
That's the only thing we're doing at this point. So.
Okay. I just want to make sure that as we, you know, once again, I know we're in a shift here, and one of the things we're going to be talking about over the next 2 to 3 to 4 weeks is actually changing our approach and changing how we look at things. And I'm not saying you haven't. I'm just saying that I would hope that things that were sort of automatic in the past, or maybe that we could do, and I'm not saying we're doing it poorly, we probably need to really sit down and perhaps delay some seal coat, do some of that, because we have to plan more carefully and really allocate our resources in a much much more conscientious manner than perhaps we had to in the past. I think that's just the reality we live in, and that's some of the things we're going to grapple with is how we're allocating resources. And so
we're doing it even on our service agreements. We used to do service agreements, which is go out there and do an asphalt patch by a contractor. We used to do those for a year contracts. We're doing 2 and 3 month service agreements because the prices are
okay.
Taking a, you know, you see, obviously
so
the market's
volatile.
Very hungry, very okay. volatile. And right now the prices are coming down. We're seeing, we had a herbicide contract come in. It was half of what it was just 6 months ago. So we're taking our service agreements and making them shorter in a time frame and just rebidding them more often just to take advantage of the market.
And, well, in a sense, you're doing a sort of a hedge kind of a thing where spot prices are better now.
Yep.
But if you see some increase, I would hope that we'd lock in a longer-term contract.
We're trying to.
But we'd like that crystal ball if someone has it to tell us.
Yeah. I think if we all had that, we wouldn't be sitting here today. We'd all be on a beach somewhere. But, okay, thank you very much. Anything else on page 3? Page 4, Councilmember Summers.
Jack, this one's for you. On item number 4G and CNC Steel, we had somebody write in today and ask some questions, so I thought I'd throw them out to you. The question is, we have a 4-inch steel line, quite a length of it going to CMC Steel, and the question was, are impact fees helping pay for that? What's the cost recovery for that before Mesa sees a profit? And then there was only one bid, and as I read it, I understand the nobody else bid. So how are we getting recovery from this? Or is it impact fees or something else? And what about single bid?
Mayor Councilman Summers, I brought two experts to the table to address those very issues.
Good evening, Mayor, Councilmember Summers. I'll address the bidding question, and then Frank will address the other question. On this project, this is a natural gas line. It's a flammable substance, and we're subject to some specific regulations, the Code of Federal Regulations Part 192 for natural gas and the Arizona Corporation Commission requirements. So we need specialty contractors that are certified and licensed and maintain appropriate certifications to do this. We pre-qualify bidders for these contracts. There are 9 in the state that can do the work. There are typically 3 that we see bid these contracts pretty routinely. We go out and publicly advertise twice in a 2-week period when we send these out. We publish those in the newspaper, and then we publish them on our website as well. And then in addition, because it's a specialty work, our gas engineers email and notify the 9 contractors by email. When we got the one bid, we called around and talked to a variety of the contractors. The majority of them already have work to satisfy what they're doing right now and weren't in a capacity to provide the service. 1 or 2 said they did not get the email, so we responded with confirmation emails, and they got the emails. So I think really it's a function of the amount of natural gas work that's out there right now in terms of the bidding. But we do a substantial outreach to get people to the table to bid it.
The one thing that seems to be doing well over the course of the economy, they're yes. still building gas
they're
lines.
They're still building gas lines, okay. Yes.
As far as the recovery of the cost, it's...
I might add that they also reviewed the bid itself against the engineering estimates and recent bids, and they conform and they're within range of being a very competitive bid.
Okay. And the cost for this is recovered over 3 years with for sale of natural gas?
Mayor, Councilman Summers, Frank McRae with the Utilities Department. We don't have an impact fee for natural gas. It's a unique kind of utilities animal from the other utility costs that are recovered through impact fees. But we look at major projects like this on a case-by-case basis, do what's called a revenue justification, meaning there's a certain amount of revenue that we project to come in from the customer. It will justify a certain amount of capital investment on our behalf. If the revenue does not justify all the capital investment, then we will impose fees like impact fees. We'll enter into an agreement that requires minimum revenues, and we'll go forward. In this instance, the amount of the cost of the line extension relative to the revenues that we see coming in from the customer is so great on the side of the revenues that we do not need an upfront contribution from the customer.
Does the state allow for an impact fee for gas service? Because not every city has a gas service. This is an enterprise fund. It's a business of the city of Mesa that generates its own revenue. So are we just operating this as a business would, or is this?
Yeah, I would say it's clearly an enterprise business. And frankly, it's an optional utility that people can choose to have or not have. So trying to determine an impact fee, I think, on a case-by-case basis would be near impossible. But as Frank said, certainly with a utility demand like CMC Steel, you can clearly sit down and do a cost-benefit analysis, which we do, and look at a payback period. And it's clearly a positive revenue generator for the
city. Frank, when we looked at this particular user, future user, where do we estimate they're going to rank as far as as the largest users in the city? Weren't they in the top 3?
They'll be in the top 4 users, depending upon the level of consumption and the pace of the increase in consumption.
That's going to be a fairly significant account for the city to have, both from a gas user as well as a job creation.
I was going to ask you, Chris, do you remember the job numbers on CMC Steel?
It was around 110, I believe.
Yeah, 110, 120, whatever. Okay.
Now, just so everyone, we're talking about CMC Steel. The reason they're using so much is that they actually have furnaces out there that melt.
Recycling.
Yeah, that melts steel.
Steel. They make rebar.
So this is number 3. Now, I know that number 1 or 2 is our jacuzzi that my wife continually sets up. What's number 2?
Number 1 is the bus barn, affectionately known as the
school district.
And then the school district is not the second largest consumer.
So this is a big user. This is the kind of user you want.
Yeah. Just to be clear, the nature of the gas use is not actually as a furnace gas, but it's as a heat treatment.
That's an electrical furnace, right?
It's electrical furnace, but they use natural gas to both preheat the metals as well as post-treat the metals.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you. Page 5, Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. I had a question from a constituent today on 4J, which is the Keno High School pool. And the question from the constituent was, this is a bid for a new gas and water line replacement in connection with the pool construction. And the constituent asked why this wasn't bid at the time that the pool was bid. And my question is this something that was discovered after the construction began at the project that has given rise to the need to do this separately?
Mayor, Councilmember Kavanaugh, yes, this project, this was actually the pool project is a construction manager at risk contract that's currently underway. We knew this service had to be replaced, and we bid this as a separate contract. We feel like it's separate from the pool itself. It actually serves the entire facility, and it's in a location where it could be bid separately. We felt like we'd get a better price, and we did get a better price doing that.
Okay, Councilmember Richards.
That same thing. I know you said that it serves the upgrade, but you know, it seems like from a funding standpoint, it shouldn't. Why isn't it quality of life, and why is it bond debt? We're incurring bond debt instead of using quality of life funds. Because if it was related to the pool, wouldn't that be a quality of life fund?
Right.
I'm the new guy here, so I'm just trying to learn.
It's not just specifically related to the pool. It also serves the school, and the age of the pipe was such that it needed to be replaced as well, so there's kind of a life cycle issue associated with it. Just one second here.
If I could put my utility hat on, you know, we see it as two supply lines to two users, the school, the pool, if you will, and it's really part of our distribution system, and therefore it would be covered under our water bonds. They're both metered, and you know, we gain revenues from it, and it's part of the business model.
It just seemed like it was related to the pool project itself, and that would be more appropriate.
Right,
to be
but
paid
Mayor
for
and Council, quality, I think
instead
this is
of incurring
also,
debt for
you're going to see, and I can't remember if it's this agenda or another agenda, where we're also moving a lot of the meters and a lot of the facilities
yes.
from underground and moving them up. So we're doing this across the city in other locations too. And I think what I'm assuming we're taking advantage of is the fact we're already out there tearing up this location. So instead of disrupting the school again, and certainly it's convenient because we're doing the pool construction, but the concrete vaults that we have the meters in today
yes.
are being replaced throughout the city. So this work would have had to been done if we didn't even do the pool. If the pool wasn't going to be done, this is work we would have come around to do at some point. We've chosen to do it now while we're under construction so that we have minimized the disruption to the school.
Okay, Councilmember Higgins. Anything else on 4J? Councilmember Higgins?
Mayor, 4I, I'm going to just preface this with, this is an annexation case from 1986, so I'm not assuming anybody here actually worked on this annexation case. But, you know, basically just for those, we're replacing 15,000 linear feet of water lines, putting in 29 fire hydrants into an annexed property that we annexed in 1986. And if we go back in history and look at the annexation documents, we had actually, the city at the time, recommended that, you know, all this work be done and that a future improvement district be put in place to actually pay for this infrastructure that's going to be needed. So I say all this to say that this is one of my other issues with how we annex property and how we don't charge up front for the long-term costs that annexing a county island actually is going to occur into the city. So in this case, you know, it's 22 years old, the life cycle of the pipes, if it was always in the city, probably would be one of those things you'd be saying we need to replace anyway. But this is, you know, property we annexed in substandard way. In fact, the whole area doesn't have a fire hydrant in it. So this is an area we annexed, again, 22 years ago. But those are some of the things that I would like us as a city to look more in depth when we talk about annexation, about, you know, some long-term fund where we put money in so that, you know, when these kind of things come up, we're not taken out of normal funding. That's it. So I know that none of you guys were here, but I just wanted to share that
Thank you.
Thought. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Summers.
I'll just echo that briefly and say that this is Dean, I think you're aware that I've been slowly working on that, the idea of that facility improvement district and annexing it so that when we get neighborhoods like these in our district in particular, it seems we can have a funding mechanism to take care of that, because the there are areas in, that don't have fire hydrants, don't have water, and don't have sewer, and they're about to, I think their septic system's about 30, 40 years old, and they live to be about 30 to 40 years old, so there are going to be issues pending. So this is something I think you and I probably can work on over the course of the next 6 months.
And it's one thing when we have a whole community come in, but we're also susceptible to annexation creep. Not annexing creeps, but annexation creep. Where we take the onesie-twosie things, and before we know it, we have an entire area that, as the orphan lots come in, they look okay, but when you put them together over years of annexing single entities all of a sudden, or single parcels, all of a sudden we have an entire collection of parcels that are going to put us in the same situation we are here. So, good point. Thank you. Vice Mayor.
Well, that is precisely why we've been working on the process of requiring the standards and the upfront kind of things instead of just automatically giving them service.
I think that's good. Thank you. Anything else on page 5? Page 6? Page 7? Page 8. Okay. Thank you. Second item on the agenda, hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on fiscal year 08, 09, and 09, 010 budget issues. As the, starting with the Development and Sustainability Department, as these, as we're coming up, just to give a little bit of a prologue, whatever you want to call it, we're going to have the major departments come before us in study sessions, as we indicated a couple weeks ago, to give presentations as to their objectives, their proposed service models, how those may or may not differentiate, and I'm assuming since they're reporting to us that it will differentiate from what is currently being followed. And so there will be a series of these. Hopefully we'll be able to, as a council, ask questions as it relates to the service model you're proposing and the effects that it has on our overall objectives and policies. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor and Council, as I think I mentioned back in on November 20th, as we rolled out the response that we have to the challenges of the new economy, I want to continue to emphasize to the Council that we have really taken this as an opportunity to really evaluate how we do things and what we do things. In some ways, we have accelerated the opportunity to make changes to how we deliver services. And today, I think you're going to hear a lot about that, where there are a lot of the process improvements and restructuring that really we were moving to in that direction for the last couple of years. Especially in development services, process becomes related to time and effort to get projects completed and through our review process. And we have really tried to continue to look at ways to improve that process, and again, now being challenged with resources, how to do that with the limited resources. So you're going to hear what we're going to present to you today is an opportunity we see to really find a way to consolidate and improve processes. It does mean that we will change not only the way we do things, but frankly, we are having, as you make these changes, and remember, as we talk about services, there's so much related to people. And not only the individuals themselves, but the skills that they bring to the services we provide. And really, as we've looked at across the city, the approach of delivering services with the jobs we have and the skills that we bring to the table, we're really evaluating internally how we do that. And I think the proposals you'll see over the next couple of weeks, we've really assessed that we have to look at, even in the future, assuming that at some point that we see opportunities for new growth or development throughout the city, I would suggest to you that we are looking at a different model of the employment base. not necessarily meaning that every time we see new growth and development that we are going to be looking at hiring more full-time employees. We are going to try to be very careful about creating specializations within our staffing. Because we see the consequences in a very dynamic and changing economy, which we believe will continue to be very dynamic and changing for the foreseeable future. And we have to build an organization that allows us to adapt and have the flexibility to bring the resources in to meet needs in a very specific way sometimes. It is very difficult to bring on employees and over a long period of time have them working in very specific areas, and then when the economy changes or development changes, when the emphasis is on green building or sustainability and energy and in the environment, we have to be able to adapt and have flexibility to make our services, our skills, adapt to that. And sometimes in the world of government, that's very difficult to do, to make those changes and the flexibility to move people in and out, to bring in specialized skills, maybe sometimes for a project, maybe for a large development. And so those are the challenges that we face. I think what you're going to hear from the department heads over the next couple of days is how they're going to look at re-engineering, is a word that we've often used, to look at the core services we would provide, but understanding that we will have the flexibility and the adaptability to bring on those specializations or to ramp up for large developments as needed. But they may not necessarily be the employees that are working with us today. They may not even be future employees. They may be employees that we bring in from outside services to assist us. And so we've already started that conversation with the third parties about how they can be a partner with us to prepare and understand the way we do things so that when we need those resources, we can call upon them. It is in a time when scarce resources are much scarcer than they ever were. The commitment that we make to bring on full-time employees is very challenging because we have to know that for a long period of time that service is going to be needed for a core service. And that's going to be more challenging, I think, into the future. So today we're going to begin with our new department. It is a dramatic change in some ways, but frankly, it's a look back to what cities were doing years ago in the last 10 years, talking about one-stop development centers and bringing together the kind of continuous process. We're literally taking this to a new way of doing it. Not only are we looking at it from who supervises it and emphasizing the importance of working together, we're literally physically, and not only programmatically, but physically relocating individuals. So this continuous process is not just something on a process per chart or some kind of chart or on paper, but it's physically relocation of individuals to share resources and share services. So before I spill much of her thunder, I'll let turn over to Christine, but I just want to understand the council. This is the beginning of what you're going to hear throughout the presentations as we bring it, is really a looking at, in this new economy, and a new economy which we are still trying to understand, which changes dramatically and very dynamically, we are looking at ways to create a very flexible core of services, but build into that the ability to flex and adapt as those needs come. Christine?
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Christine Zelanka with the Development Services Department. I have John Wesley here. I also have a variety of team members here, so if the questions come up, I'm going to ask them to just come up and help me. I wanted to share a little bit of the background that we've been through over the last several months, quite frankly, as we have been evaluating our current economic situation, what our current organization looks like. I'm actually going to share some examples of things that we've learned over the last couple of years from specific projects on successes and also opportunities for improving the way we do business, to share some of those examples and then to relate those to the organizational and the process changes that we're looking at. Our primary focus through this entire process has really been looking at process improvement, how we can do a better job of meeting the needs of the development community while we consolidate and meet our current economic challenges. The goals that we identified for ourselves is first improve the efficiency of existing staff so that we can reduce costs, consolidate operations, streamline processes so we can do a more efficient job of utilizing our staff relative to working with the development community, working with our various boards and other support functions that we're challenged with. One of the major goals that we also wanted to emphasize and really put out there at the beginning of development projects is planning, developing, and promoting sustainable communities. And there's numerous aspects to that. Oftentimes we hear of that as the three-legged stool. We really figured that that was a four-legged table, quite frankly, that there's the economic sustainability piece of it. One of the commitments that I have made for the last 2 years is to absolutely be there to help support economic development, looking at the jobs impact and how we can really help promote development projects that improve Mesa's job base. The environmental sustainability piece of it, resource conservation, and then also neighborhood sustainability, looking at ways that we can work with neighborhoods to build the community to begin with, but then identify procedures and processes to keep those neighborhoods strong and healthy throughout the duration.
Ms. Solanka, I mean, there are those in the community who would say, wait a second, you're trying to socially engineer, love that term, and force people to do things. And as I see this, this is not what we're trying to accomplish. We have the community has a vested interest in seeing sustainable neighborhoods also, mm-hmm. because neighborhoods that are not sustainable, and sustainable meaning we're able to service them without wasting resources or without extending our resources beyond our ability to service them, that's a non-sustainable neighborhood, mm-hmm. in my view. And we're experiencing this right now, where we have areas in our city where we struggle to provide levels of service. And we admittedly fall short in meeting some of our own internal standards for providing high quality of service. So part of the objective here in creating an emphasis on sustainability, as I understand it, is also to do something that the community basically benefits from, because it brings into focus this matching of community resources with growth and with development. Am I understanding this correctly?
You're absolutely correct. And what we want to do here, good job, is focusing on that sustainable piece of it early on in the development process. The discussion that you just had relative to outlying areas of the city to make sure that we can serve them, that we can get infrastructure out there in a cost-effective manner.
Well, not only can we serve them, for example, putting a leapfrog development which creates in its own sphere maybe good traffic, but they have to travel over roads which really create a strain on existing resources, or they're so far out that they create a strain on public safety resources, that's also what we would try to avoid.
That's right.
Now, there are some who would argue that, well, Mesa Proving Grounds is way out on the fringe, but I think the approach we've taken on Mesa Proving Grounds is to create a sustainable community that takes into account these and will develop in a sense where this balance is maintained.
So. Absolutely. In fact, we're going to use the Mesa Proving Grounds as one of the examples of the lessons that we've learned.
Then I'll be quiet and let you continue.
That's fine. Feel free to help out.
Thank you.
Okay. Let me see. The new development and sustainability department, and again, Mayor, to go to your point exactly, trying to focus on that sustainability piece early on and throughout the development process. The big challenge that we identified here was to really look beyond current department boundaries to consolidate and incorporate process improvements and to align all of our process to deliver those quality developments that we're looking for. Obviously, one of our challenges relative to the current economic conditions is to right-size our existing staff, and then as the city manager was talking about, to plan for future growth and how can we be responsive in the future when development does come back so that we can meet those demands while maintaining our current management of our existing workload. We thought we'd talk about three specific examples to bring up some of the successes that we've experienced and some of the improvements that we thought we could implement. Those three are the West Main Street sub-area plan and the major emphasis there on transit-oriented development, the Mesa Proving Grounds that I know everyone's familiar with, and The major issue there is really this interdisciplinary, multifunctional, collaborative effort across the city where we need to look at city infrastructure, we need to look at streets, we need to look at water and wastewater, we need to look at parks and libraries. It's just required us to look at the entire city and see how we could create that sustainable development out there. And then the other example I wanted to talk specifically about is the conversion of the Banner Mesa Office Center. This was really brought to our attention about 2 years ago as an economic development opportunity where we could take an existing building, work with the developer, identify what their goals were, and quite frankly, those were fiscal constraints. And how could we work with the owner of that building to actually get it to a reuse situation? And I think, quite frankly, that that's been one of the major successes in that West Main area of bringing jobs, keeping jobs, and working to convert that building to a future use. Just to talk briefly about the transit-oriented development, this is a picture of the new Sycamore Station, and I know everybody is very excited about the light rail coming up. But what we wanted to focus on here is this was part of a sub-area plan, and the sub-area plans were really using to help guide future development. The transit-oriented approach in particular along West Main Street to try to plan for future development. How can we encourage development along Main Street to get that higher density, high use, mixed use environment while transitioning then out to the neighborhoods as you move several blocks to the north and south of Main Street. So a couple of the lessons learned as far as the transit-oriented approach, the importance of collaboration with our citizens. And that's certainly an area that we want to continue to focus on, but look at how do we maximize our existing resources so that we do the best job possible and still get that input from the city, from our citizens. This was also an example of having to really look at existing infrastructure. Did we have the water and sewer lines there? Are we going to have them in the future to accommodate a higher density of use? The involvement with transportation and engineering as to our existing road standards here and how they work with us to develop a flexible solution to a very unique development opportunity there. The next example that I wanted to bring up, and the reason I'm showing this slide, is this, I think, really shows all of the various disciplines that came to the table to present the final community plan for the Mesa Proving Grounds that you recently approved. This required incredible collaboration with the engineering department, transportation. Obviously, these roads don't look like the normal Mesa grid system. Required engineering and utilities to look at unique design solutions for things like water, wastewater, stormwater retention. Parks, libraries, and solid waste were also included in these discussions to really come to the table, work with development planning to figure out what the long-term solutions could be for this area. Quick example here, just an example on the street cross-sections. Again, this does not look like the standard City of Mesa, Mesa Drive kind of a development scenario where we needed numerous disciplines across the city to be looking at alternative design solutions, working with the developer to see what their vision was, and then how we could develop specific solutions looking beyond what our normal development standards are. The one challenge that we also had with the development of Mesa Proving Grounds was long-term sustainability and how can we look at things that the developer proposed alternative retention standards. These are examples of rain gardens and some more creative retention basins that typically don't exist in Mesa, and our challenge was to see how we can work again across city lines to figure out ways to come up with alternative solutions that are going to work for the next 20 to 40 years. One of the early on planning solutions that John had talked about previously, if you look at the schematic diagram over on the right of the screen here, and talking about site plan development potential, of looking at planning opportunities early on in the process and how can we plan for not only the land use but the city infrastructure as those developments evolve over time and the intensity hopefully increases. We also wanted to look at ways that we can utilize our resources to make sure that we're being responsive to market-driven conditions. As the economy changes, as development requirements change, how can we make sure that we've got an organizational structure in place that can be adaptive and that can work with developers to make sure we get the quality of development project that they're looking for?
If I may jump in here just real quick, one more thing from this that we worked very hard on was that establishing the high-quality design up front in the process so that later on more things can push down to Planning and Zoning Board, to staff to review, and not so many things have to come so far through the review process to get them approved and on with the construction.
Right. Now, we think that's also...
Well, and that differs from how we do things now, whereas we come through, there's a site plan, and then through a separate process... We have a whole design review process, which is almost separate and distinct from any of the other things we do.
Right.
And that I'm assuming it creates, well, I'm not assuming, I've been through it. So it creates a bunch of different challenges, both for staff, as far as staff utilization, also as far as time delays and other things that go on. Now, do you think you can accomplish the same, because one of the... If what I'm hearing now, that process is going to be consolidated into one overriding process. Is that what I'm hearing?
But, Mayor, in terms of the DMB process, yes, it is. That's what we've done there. We'll all go through together and go to the Planning and Zoning Board to be approved by staff. And as we'll talk about in a little bit with the consolidation, we're looking now at how we can do that by consolidating the functions of staff. Even more than we have in the past, where we've had the subdivision planner, the P&Z planner, the design review planner, we'll be having a person that can be responsible for all of those areas that can address each of those areas with one project, so there's not as many handoffs in that process.
Okay, and as we go through that, I'll let you get onto that, but as you go through that, if we can just make sure you identify how we are going to maintain the kind of standards that we want to get to through that new process.
Right, I think the key is what we lessons learned is it is much... We can integrate design elements and standards at the early on when we're talking about a variety of other discussions on the site plan. And I think we found that was a lot easier discussion to build in that qualitative part at the front end. And we'll talk about this when we get into the actual kind of logistics of our staffing, but we would like council to consider that we think that that's a better way to do things, to negotiate, if you would, and really begin to develop that design component on the very front end, and then there's kind of that quality control to complete that through the process, and we'll talk about that here in just a little bit.
I think one of the examples, to use the DMB, we received P&Z and council approval at that high level of those negotiated design standards, but then subsequent projects, specific projects as they come through, will be much more streamlined because there will be basically a staff approval that's already been authorized by P&Z and council.
What I'm assuming then is we'd take the same basic standard, but on a more, because we wouldn't look at each project and negotiate standards.
Correct.
You know, we're going to, you know, that was a huge project.
Right.
It was a major change, huge ramifications. So we'll establish some sort of well-defined standard that anyone coming into the process would be able to know, perhaps follow a graphical and narrative, just like we did with Mesa Proving Grounds, and those would be the standards we'd follow. Or establish something similar that we would...
Yeah, and I think we have the opportunity with the update that we're engaged in that is going to use a lot more graphics and build that character into that update that we can then use on the front end.
Correct.
And so the idea that someone, before they even came in, would have a pretty good idea of what was expected.
Right, okay. And I think that sort of links to the sub-area plans where sort of the character and the nature of different areas of Mesa. There's a different character that we're looking for in the Mesa Proving Grounds compared to the Lehigh area, Falcon Field, or West Main, and perhaps those design characteristics would change for each of those areas, but they would be known up front.
Okay.
Okay, one of the other examples that I wanted to talk to, and this has really been, I think, a tremendous opportunity for both city staff, and I think that the owner of the facility would agree with us, that we were able to take the old Mesa Lutheran Hospital, which was then Banner Mesa, and it's now being converted into an office facility, where we met with the developer early on. We said, okay, what do you need? What are your fiscal constraints? What are your time restraints? And then we looked back at our processes and said, okay, this is the developer's timeline. What can we do to make that happen? And quite frankly, early on in the process, we laid out a schedule for ourselves. We said, okay, we need to look at little more flexibility in our landscaping and the parking requirements. We've got an existing parking area out there. Are there ways that we can allow not a huge amount of investment in that parking area and in the landscaping to bring it up to a level certainly that the neighbors require, but how can we keep that on track for the developer? We also looked at the road improvements out there. There were some questions as to what was a realistic assessment of what the road improvements were going to need to be, and looking at the eventual use of that facility, was there going to be an increased capacity? Were we really expecting that we'd have more vehicle trips every day when it turned into an office building compared to when it was a hospital? And again, that was an example of looking at the long-term potential up front, saying, okay, is it really going to have an increased capacity on the roads, or are the existing roads and the current configuration going to be adequate to serve that facility over the next 10 years? We also had to look at existing infrastructure. Would the existing water, wastewater lines serve the facility? One of the major ways that we were able to save time on the part of city staff, time for the developer, is our permit by inspection program. We have literally been working with the developer on every single floor of that building where they didn't come in with plans at the beginning of the process. We have actually been out there with our inspectors reviewing the work as it occurs and issuing basically permits by inspection. This has been a tremendous time saver for the developer to keep them on track. One of the other major areas that we worked with the developer here as far as reuse and infill development was the existing building code, where we actually had to work with their design team and sort of educate them on some of the options and the flexibility that are built into the building code, where you can reuse an existing building and you don't have to use the same criteria as a new building. Took a little bit of upfront work, took a little bit of education on our part to explain to the building owner basically how they could save money, meet basic life safety issues, but not have to go back and comply with the current building code.
Councilmember Summers.
Christine, before you go on to these next slides, are you telling me that some of the reorganization and the new processes that you are looking to put in place in this new department were tried, tested, and succeeded on the BMOC building?
Basically, what we are looking at there, we expanded what our sort of small box had been for permit by inspection, and we said, okay, this is a much larger facility. We would not normally do permit by inspection for such a large building, but let's try it and see if it works. And quite frankly, yeah, we've said that was a successful model, and we think that we could expand the permit by inspection to larger buildings than what we have historically been doing for the last couple of years.
When you go through these next few slides, I get the preview. The people at home don't. Would you just kind of point out where some of which ones of these processes were used in that BMOC, sure, so I can see how this works out?
Okay. Think about that. Was kind of the idea of bringing up these examples so we can show how we've, again, taken those lessons learned and bringing them forward.
And the other examples, too.
Okay.
Wherever they fit in, I'd like to see how this helps me put it together. Thanks.
Okay. Just to summarize what the new development and sustainability department will include, and again, I want to emphasize that this is a very flattened organizational structure compared to what we've had in the past based on our current economic challenges. Planning services is the kind of the first piece of it. Development planning works hand in hand with planning services, and this is Councilmember Summers, where some of the challenges at DMB, where we were looking at what does the city infrastructure need to be, which is the development planning piece, and then how does that work with the design standards and the land use regulations that are coming forward through the planning process. We then also have construction plan review and permitting. This is the classic building safety plan review piece of it. One of the improvements that we're recommending there is that we're actually looking at a consolidated plan review, where we're looking at zoning plan review, fire plan review, and building plan review, all being done by one multidisciplinary group. So again, as John talked about earlier, that's not multiple handoffs within city staff, but you basically got one group that's looking at agreements that have been made early on in the planning process and taking them all the way through the final permitting process.
Councilmember Summers.
I was going to say this to the end, but let me throw it out there. Whenever you break, you're talking about taking various silos of specialization and breaking those down and cross-training some folks. And this is the plan review is one of those examples. There are others in this department, but let's look at this one. That requires folks have knowledge of more than just their area of specialization, building or fire protection or whatever the other issues are. So how are we going to get the people that are going to be staying in this organization? I would assume that they're not trained in all the various silos, so how are we going to make an upfront investment in education and training so that we break down that specialization and we have broad base so that one each and every individual understands each component, or how's that going to work out?
That's a great point. I have always fought very hard for training and educational funding in our budget, and we have maintained that. There are ICC certifications for pretty much everything except the zoning code. There are specific fire certifications. And yes, absolutely, we will continue to invest in our staff to make sure that they are able to take advantage of the training opportunities. Yes, sir, did you have something to say?
No, I was going
to I'm sorry, it looks like you're going to say something. We will continue to encourage our staff and require them when we can to make sure that they have those certifications. One of our big challenges over the next month to 6 weeks is cross-training and making sure that we do have that multidisciplinary functionality. The other answer to the question, I think, is the outsourcing possibilities that we're building into this that I haven't quite gotten to, but certainly there are projects that could come forward that are going to challenge our existing resources or our existing level of expertise. And one of the opportunities that we have is to improve our outsourcing contracts and bring particular expertise to the table when we need it.
I might also add just real quick, we've already started that training process and identifying training plans for those that are going to be here to get up to speed on the things that they need to know.
And for us, Mayor and Council, this is the right time to do this, not only to look at our processes, and again, as I said, really flatten this out, not necessarily build in a lot of specialties at this point, because the workload is such that it allows us time, if you would, to retool our employees. And for some of them, it may be adding more tools to their toolbox or certifications on their plaques, but it allows us to take the opportunity when the workload isn't so frantic that we, you know, we're scrambling just to try to keep up. This gives us an opportunity to really reevaluate what we can do best, and there may be opportunities to cross-train and bring some of that in-house. It very may well be that we don't necessarily staff up for every specific specialty that we're required to conduct, because those instances of those types of reviews may not come along frequently enough now for us to justify, at least for now, the retaining or the hiring of an individual who may have that one special certification or skill that is used periodically during a review. So that's how we're trying to evaluate the staffing skills that we have.
The other part of that answer, just from my perspective, is that we need depth in the organization, that I just don't think we have the luxury of having those specialty areas, that we need to have staff that has a pretty highly functional knowledge of the various disciplines that we're talking about, including fire, including the various aspects of building, including zoning, that if that one person isn't there, I've got additional staff that have that expertise, and at the same time, they have the knowledge to know this is beyond what I can do. If we get a high-end semiconductor plant coming in, it's possible and probable that we would probably outsource a fair amount of that plan review because it's a niche specialty that I don't have in-house, but I've got the resources to bring in that level of specialty from outside.
But we'll know what types of certifications that an individual with those specialties should have, so if they come in and say, we want to do a semiconductor, we say, great, you got to get plans signed off by somebody who's certified.
Sure. Yeah, hazardous materials and fire, specific issues there.
Right. I would also hope, and I guess to understand better, we're not saying that every person in this department is going to have all certifications and everything. I mean, but the way it's done now is that you, for example, if you have three separate reviews, fire, engineering, whatever they are, they literally could go to three different people in three different buildings, not only departments, but different buildings. So you have a a personal separation, you have a physical separation, and what you're proposing to do is that they would come into one group in one building and stay there, and you may have two or three different people working on that, but they're really in one, under one umbrella.
Right.
I'm also hoping that if we do go to outside services, that they undergo some sort of training so that they not only, we know that they have the technical expertise, but I think one of the biggest challenges we're going to have under this model is the customer service model. And I can see, and having experienced outside services with other municipalities, where the whole thing can come to a grinding halt when you have someone who's outside who technically is very good, and they'll do everything they can to show you how technically good they are, including sitting on plans for 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks. So I'm hoping that even with our outside contractors or whoever we use, that they are also schooled and sorted and filtered for the customer service model that we'd have. Councilmember Summers.
Is that something where we would outsource it? We would just tell whoever's bringing the project forward, you have to get it certified by,
you know, I've seen it,
and a certain skill set, and you
belong to it. I've seen it done in different ways. One, we could bring, literally, we could bring as almost like a temporary service individual who has unfamiliar with our code and have them come sit in our cubicles and work on plans, or it literally, the plans could be sent out to a third party for it to be reviewed, and as long as we know that review's taken place, mm-hmm. that would be a way to sign off on it. Now, I think to the mayor's point is, we're already talking with those vendors out there. We want them to create capacity, too. There needs to be competition and choices for us. So as the mayor says, if we're not getting the service, the turnaround times that we need to be able to have that ability to, you know, make sure that that customer satisfaction is being addressed also.
Yeah, and choices for the customer, too, because folks, some of the larger ones, DMB, for example, may have that specialty either built in or they already have a relationship with somebody who does that work.
Yeah.
And the ability for them to go out and say, we got our person, we're going to go use them, but we'll have the plans in next week instead of 8 weeks or whatever the example was. There's a certain positive customer service impact to that as well.
If I could just break in there real quickly, one of the options that we have that we're going to talk about here is the ability of a developer actually to fund that outsource plan review, and that's, we're talking to one of our other developers right now. Certainly we already have that model established with DMB, where they came in initially, said they wanted essentially a project manager to shepherd the project through. They have been funding that position. We're in the process of talking about them funding basically the plan review. If they have an engineering assessment where we've got alternative engineering solutions, there's I think 100 of them or something, that they need a designated or quantifiable amount of engineering time. If we can't supply that in-house, that we contract, and they've already were talking about this, that they fund that specialty engineering service, come back, give the city the answer, give us the solution, but basically the developer pays for it. There's always got to be a city review on that. We're looking at self-certification programs. The jury is still out on that. We're actually going to be working on it. But that kind of goes to the idea that the developer or the design professional is coming in and certifying that they meet all of the codes, but there's some level of an audit procedure that the city has.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand the audit. I've always been fascinated, though, how, you know, you have certain professional certifications. You have CPAs that are certified. And we as a city will accept a certified financial statement from a CPA, and we don't perform another audit.
Mm-hmm.
And yet on the plan review, we'll bring a set of plans that are stamped by a professional engineer who certify that they've gone through a certain thing, and then we start from scratch and review the engineers. I understand that at a certain level we need to audit the work, mm-hmm. but I'd like to look at a place where, once again, we can use these resources that exist in the market and allow the developers the opportunity to go out, and for some reason, when someone walks in with a professional seal, and we need to look and make sure that, you know, what their qualifications are, but the fact that they have that professional seal would seem like that should go a long way toward accomplishing our purposes.
You would think so.
Yeah, well, but my experience has been that hasn't been the case. You walk in and, well, you might as well have nothing.
Yeah, I've challenged a couple of folks to bring me such a good set of plans that it can be approved on the first time through.
Yeah, well, I think we ought to be moving toward setting up
You're
a
right.
system where we rely on, if we're going to have those kind of certifications, that we set up a system where we can easily audit and not redo work, mm-hmm. that is already being done by qualified professionals. And it accelerates the process.
Right, and we've actually had that discussion with developers. One of the things that we're going to be doing is having a similar kind of a discussion with the development community on December 10th through the Developers Advisory Forum. And one of our options, or one of the suggestions that we're going to have, is actually to get a subgroup together and look at that self-certification program and see if we can't come forward with some proposals that'll work for us.
Great. Okay.
Okay. And I know that I'm a little bit late on time, so I'll try to move through these fairly quickly. Let me see. We've pretty much been talking about the development planning and entitlement process. Again, this idea that we physically got people together, that we've got single points of contact to take a process from the early on entitlement procedures all the way through variations to the general plan, the modifications to the zoning code that we can go through. But the John staff is basically focused on one individual taking a project all the way through, so there's not a handoff. Consolidated plan review, I think we pretty well talked about this, but again, the idea that you've got a multidisciplinary approach to plan review. We've got folks that have more depth within there, but we're still focusing on fire plan review, civil plan review, and that we've got folks that have these specific certifications and certainly the qualifications that we need as a city to make sure that they're meeting our standards. One of the major changes to the department is consolidated inspections and enforcement. The Development and Sustainability Department is assuming responsibility for code compliance inspections. And this is, I think, a tremendous example of the opportunity for cross-training and taking advantage of one individual who's, say, out in a geographic area, that they can be doing a building inspection and they can be hitting particular code compliance issues if they're in that geographic area. So we've got one individual out there rather than maybe three or four from different departments.
Would you anticipate that as activity goes back that we would continue that same process, or would we then split into separate staff? Because I think that's one of the concerns is that, yeah, that works fine now. Mm-hmm. But what happens when we get really busy and all of a sudden the building inspectors are busy full-time with that? Are we going to go back to the way we're doing, or do you anticipate long-term maintaining a larger staff with cross-training?
You know, Mayor, I think that's something we have to look at, because at some point, if our building activity is growing so dramatically, you know, you're taking a higher skilled, higher compensated person to do both responsibilities. And at some point, there may be an economy that says maybe it's not in the best interest to have them keep doing code compliance. But we've actually created it so we have both under this proposal. But we are sharing more of the responsibility on the building sector side to do code compliance. Especially throughout the large part of the city, we think we're actually building in the capacity to respond better to the building activity than we would if we were just trying to respond directly to the way the economy looks today and what the actual building activity is. We would probably have to reduce more of our building inspectors.
Okay. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you. One of the concerns I have with this particular approach in code compliance is our code compliance officers have a very good relationship with our law enforcement staff, with our neighborhood services staff, with our city council staff, quite frankly, and that they're an integral part of communication between those entities, between the council and between residents. And so I would hope that even with integrating this into the model as we talk about here, that we don't lose sight of the fact that those other contacts, communications, and relationships are very, very important for neighborhood sustainability.
Good point.
Vice Mayor?
And one more to add to that, Vice Dennis, is the neighborhood leaders. You mentioned everybody else, but it's the neighborhood leaders that we're going to be losing part of that with, that we need to make sure we don't lose focus of that interaction and engagement with the neighborhood.
Correct. And I believe we're keeping six?
Yes.
Six
in special areas.
Yeah. And there's special areas, and really in the areas where we have the concentrated need and probably where a lot of the interaction is taking place. But it is an opportunity for our building inspectors who work in those areas. And actually, building inspectors under our, I just forgot the name of the team that works with PD, work with PD and
action team.
Our action teams actually are now working more in that broader perspective, because a lot of times there are issues that are happening on the facility or the building, the home, whatever, that code can't deal with. And yet now we have a building inspector, and especially under the proposed or under the new program that we the voters have approved, we are going to be bringing them closer into that whole action team concept throughout the city.
Good.
Yeah, I think this is probably one of your biggest challenges, is because there are, with code compliance, so many ancillary contacts, and you bring in, for example, most of the council, their constituent services really get down to code compliance issues in a lot of ways, either problems with neighbors or enforcement of codes, things like that. So I think this is going to be one of our biggest challenges, is how to integrate not only the people, because I have no doubt that a building inspector can do a code compliance, but it's the follow-up and the interaction that I think we're going to really have to monitor if we go to this model.
And I think that's going to put a more activity on our neighborhood services area too. I think that they've been integrated with code compliance. We did that specifically at some point. I think they're going to have to become more eyes and ears too out in the field. And so those neighborhood service representatives are going to, coordinators are going to have to play a bigger role maybe in helping out with code compliance issues also.
Councilmember Summers.
I was going to bring this up at the end, but I was, might as well do it now because Mr. Brady might actually hit a point that was interesting related to code compliance. Code compliance seemed to be, just in the 2.5 years I've been here, bounced around from PD to neighborhood services. They just keep getting shuffled, and I'm curious as to how their integration now into a consolidated, what's the name of it again? Sustainability Department. Development and Sustainability Department. I'm going to have it tattooed somewhere so I know what it is.
It means they'll go with DSD.
How is that going to impact the voter-improved rental inspection program, the slum landlord law that still have to implement?
Actually,
do you see that strengthening?
Absolutely. Because
and
now
tell
we
me
have
how.
Those, well, because now, before when it was just co-compliance, we were actually having to think about how we were going to give special training to either co-compliance officers or, I'm assuming, going over to the building inspection side and borrowing some of those skills, because this is not, now we're inside the building. Now we're looking at building code violation, health safety issues related to the building code. Well, our expertise in that area is in building inspectors, not in code. Code is trained really for outside the walls. And looking at that, now we have someone who has the certifications and has the experience that they can go inside a building. And remember, this is under limited occasions. We have to be there under the permission of the property owner, a tenant, I believe. And so now we have someone, most likely that program would require someone who had a certifications experience as a building inspector. Well, we've now integrated those programs together. So frankly, I think we've given our opportunity to bring that program that we can be prepared.
Beef it
to,
up.
We can be prepared to respond to very quickly now.
This will be something I'm going to be very interested in watching and how that develops, because it may actually have a positive impact on that program in the short term as well. But again, it goes back to my previous point 10 minutes ago about cross training and making sure that we have that adequately funded for this. Thank you.
Just a couple of quick examples of how the consolidated inspections will work. This is an example of preliminary grading and drainage work on a site. We've got a building inspector that would be out there potentially looking at footing inspections, looking to make sure that the setbacks are proper from a zoning perspective, and then they can also do the air quality and the stormwater inspections. So we've got one person that can be out there taking care of all of those various responsibilities rather than three or four that currently do it. Same time, going back to the neighborhoods, if there's a code compliance issue in that geographic area, we'd have one person that could deal with that. Just another quick example of the integration between air quality, in this case blowing PM10, and doing a grading and drainage inspection. This is a picture of our the city court that's coming up out of the ground now, and again with consolidated inspections here, we would have the building inspections done. We could also do the zoning, air quality, stormwater, and code compliance within that geographic area. One of the areas I wanted to emphasize is the desert uplands. I think this is one area where we really will be able to improve our inspections performance, where we'll have more building inspectors out there in that desert uplands area that will be able to do a better job of monitoring the development out there to conform with the desert uplands standards. Just a quick example, I think, of the cross-training opportunities here. This was a structure that was built in an area of the city that pretty clearly is a life safety issue. They actually had electricity into this area. But this is the kind of thing where if a building inspector drove by, they wouldn't have blinders on. They could see that we've got a consideration, we've got an issue here that needs to be followed up on. Quickly, just to go through our sustainability goals here, again, we're looking to really talk about sustainability, encourage conservation, encourage appropriate development standards early on in the process. A good example, Councilmember Summers, is the DMB 21st Century Desert Urbanism that was talked about constantly, and our challenge was, okay, how are you going to do that? What are the sustainable techniques that you're going to be incorporating? Those were also, I think we've got those as aspirational goals in the Mesa Gateway Strategic Development Plan. Another couple of things, actually a few projects that you're going to be seeing fairly soon, brownfields redevelopment, infrastructure opportunities and challenges, zoning code flexibility.
Brownfields are not like greenfields. Brownfields are environmental mitigation.
Well, it could be environmental, but it can also be underutilized property from an economic standpoint.
Okay.
And we've actually got one project right now that I think you got a letter on that's probably in your in-basket, where we've got a pro bono group that's helping us with a property that's on the 202 in Higley that actually belongs to state land, where we've got a regional group that's going to help us look at development opportunities for that site. The zoning code flexibility is something that we previously talked about, looking at ways that we can build in flexibility in zoning code, particularly in geographic areas of the city. And one of our goals there, connecting transportation and land use. We really aspire to be a regional leader in sustainability. There's a new city group that's being formed to look at things that municipal government can do to encourage sustainability. Scott Boucher, our environmental and sustainability office, has been involved in that and sort of as a charter member of that group, of really looking at benchmarking that we can do as municipal governments.
And Mayor, just this is an opportunity too. Again, we talk about sustainability. One of the reasons we wanted to move it from the water conservation, energy conservation, out of utilities and put it over in this development services area is, again, the effect that we can have in the planning up front with design, incorporating the sustainable practices in the actual development up front, which may affect the design, the landscaping, and the layout of buildings. And so we feel like that's very important to have this group who's very much part of the front end part of the design element and incorporating that in early on with a developer, as opposed to, you know, even as we go through zoning and create the site plan, is how do we incorporate that early on so it benefits both the development, looks at that as a positive long-term investment, and obviously from a community, the, you know, whatever we can do to conserve, you know, the water conservation or energy, that helps all of us at the same time. So again, this goes back to that concept of incorporating design elements early on in the process.
Let's just move through the, I think we've talked about these, if we get responding to future growth. And this is, I wanted to bring up a few specific examples of the kinds of things that we're looking at doing and have already talked about to some extent. The opportunities, I think one of our major challenge is to respond to the current economic condition while planning in for responding to future growth. And how do we do that? How can we position ourselves to make sure that we are there and we can respond to the next increasing cycle? We're talking about right-sizing currently for the current workload. There's no question that we're in a significant economic downturn. We've talked about outsourcing contracts to meet future demand. One of the opportunities that we're looking at there, historically, the contracts with architectural and engineering firms have been a little bit cumbersome, quite frankly. We're looking at actually working with temporary agencies. So when we've got City of Mesa employees that have been separated but have that expertise, have the history, know the city systems, if they're interested in doing contract work, that we could bring them in very quickly, very easily, to respond to, say, a particular project as it comes in, or if we have an increase in workload for a short period of time, that we can use those outsourcing contracts, those temporary workers, the expertise that's going to exist out there because of our downsizing to deal with specific projects. The partnering with outsourcing, Mayor, I think you identified that we need continuous training. The care and management of consultants is a major task when you're outsourcing, to make sure that they do understand the city system, that they're meeting the customer satisfaction goals that we absolutely have, and that there's certainly a management component of outsourcing. It can't just run amok by itself. That includes continuous training of consultants, quality control checks, and then, as I said, working with former employees to the extent that, folks are available and willing to do that.
And I hate to, don't want to cut you off, but I look at the slides that have come up, and I think we've pretty much covered
most of
those
have.
Things. I just would like to ask you one thing as it relates to, since this is, you know, a budget type of a situation, and although we're mixing, as Mr. Brady said, basically changing the way that we, in our service model, with which also has budget ramifications, I'm assuming that these changes that you've that you proposed fit in with the budget goals and the overall savings and cost reductions that we have proposed. And that when we get through this, we'll pull this together with actual dollar amounts as to what that brings in. Councilmember Higgins?
Mayor, I just have a quick question. Typically, you know, your times of slowdown is when you do your sub-area plans and your long-range planning. Where does that fit now in your new department? Who's going to be sitting down with the neighbors and the groups and writing the sub-area plans and the longer-range planning?
The emphasis for the short term will be on implementing the existing sub-area plans and really making sure that the goals that have been outlined and adopted move forward. With the downsizing that we're experiencing, I'll be honest, ability to do additional sub-area plans is going to be significantly limited. Certainly, I think John's goal is to do as much of it as he can with the resources that he's going to have. But again, the emphasis will be on implementation of the existing sub-area plans.
And in the past, we've actually had to budget specifically for sub-area plans. So what I'd suggest to the council, if that's an interest from a budgetary standpoint, if we say we really have a need for another sub-area plan in a certain part of the city, then that should be a budget discussion to allocate additional resources for that, which may include both internal as well as external assistance to accomplish those.
And I'd like to see that, because I think that the sub-area plans go beyond a regulatory. I think what we've established is that we're using these sub-area plans to create an environment and create a framework that will encourage development, which, you know, sort of fits into our long-term plan to create a sustainable city. And a city that is one that investment seeks out to and wants to come here. And I think if we don't create the tools, we're sort of going to be self-defeating in what we want to accomplish.
Right. I think we would recommend, we think there's value in doing them, but I think we would like to, that needs to be a strategic decision by the council.
Well, as we go through the next budget process, which is
absolutely identified
sooner than later, considering we're going to hit it in just a couple, three short months,
right.
I would probably think that would like to at least address that and
great.
Give us alternatives, because we need to concentrate on those too.
Okay,
are there any other questions?
We'll pass for now.
Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Welcome.
Mr. James, Mr. Cl- I think we're going to have to reschedule our transportation.
Yes, we can. He's so anxious to. What we'll do, Mayor, is we'll just add
that Thursday
for Thursday. So okay. We'll have police, library, and transit. We'll cover on Thursday then.
We'll cover what on Thursday?
I'm sorry. The departments we'll cover on Thursday will be the police department, library, and transit.
Okay. All right. So a short meeting.
So you're going to serve lunch?
Okay. Let's acknowledge receipt of minutes to various boards.
So moved
by Councilmember Summers, second by the Vice Mayor. Favor? Aye.
Aye.
Okay, we have two requests to speak, and normally in a study session we do not take input from the public since it's a presentation of information. If Mr. Gould and Ms. Mikus, if you'd like to speak as part of the citizens present, we can do that. If you'd still like to address the council. Are they here?
That, or we could do them at the email.
We can just send you an email.
If you'd like to do that, or even talk to the particular members of staff with your, would love to have it. Yeah, email, that'd be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Email.
Okay.
I know you're fighting time.
That, thank you so very much for participating. We look forward to your input. Thank you. Do we have any other requests, Ms. Crocker?
No, Mayor, we do not.
Okay. Yes, Councilmember Higgins. Well, it's not on the agenda, and it would.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. Okay. No, I asked them if they wanted to speak now. That's fine. They can speak. They want to do an email. Okay. All righty. Mr. Brady, anything we need to do before you come up?
Just, I'm from scheduling Thursday morning. You heard.
Okay.
If you want to bring a packet from Transit would be good, or we can collect those and bring them back on Thursday. Whatever works best for you, let us know.
Bring them back. Okay. Entertain a motion to adjourn?
No, Mayor?
Yes,
just
Councilmember
one
Higgins.
Quick thing. I want to invite everybody on Saturday, December 6th, I'm way off, to the pancake breakfast that will be at Station 214 on Wrecker Road, just south of Thomas, and come out and meet your staff, chat with people in District 5, and make sure you bring some canned goods, which will be donated to the United Food Bank to help at this time of year. So okay. Please come and visit and have the firemen make some pancakes that will go down real easy. Thank you.
Okay, we have a motion by the Vice Mayor, second by Councilmember Summers to adjourn. All in favor?
Aye.
We are.